Hello, and welcome to The Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Patty Campbell, coming to you today from New Haven, Connecticut, the home of Yale University, which in 2012 is having its first Summer Writers Workshop. And I'm here today with a Yale graduate who has been invited to come back to teach at the Writers Workshop. Her name is Eileen Pollack. Eileen, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks so much for asking me.
I was particularly interested in having you come on to the program, one, because you are a writer, but also because you're a teacher. Now, I know that you did an MFA at the University of Iowa, and you teach now at the University of Michigan.
That's right.
And you've written a textbook.
Yes, with another about to be finished. So,
and the textbook is very fascinating to me because it's called Creative Nonfiction, A Guide to Form, Content, and Style with Readings. This whole concept of creative nonfiction, I thought fiction was supposed to be the creative part, and nonfiction was supposed to be true. So for me and for our listeners, help us with this concept.
Well, I should start by saying that what's creative about creative nonfiction is not the, you know, lying or making up what happened. The given is that it's nonfiction, that you're writing about something that really happened, whether to you or to someone else. And I'm not of the James Frey school of you can make things up if it makes a better story. To me, the power of nonfiction is that you are putting your material out there with a label on it that says to your readers, believe this. It may sound crazy, it may sound unlikely, but I'm telling you that this happened, or this is true, or this is scientific fact. And without that label, you know, you only have fiction. You don't have a way to get that power of readers believing you. Now, when I was at Yale, I studied with a wonderful man, a wonderful writer named John Hersey, who wrote Hiroshima, among other books.
Oh, yes. Many of my listeners will be very familiar
right.
with him.
And, you know, he was very old school about the difference between nonfiction and fiction. And so I, you know, grew up with, you know, this fear of, and then I worked as a reporter, and if I had made anything up, I would have been fired immediately. So what is creative about nonfiction? It's a creative presentation of the truth. You're trying to present to your readers the truth in such a way that they are going to be interested in it. Okay, so, you know, a documentary, good documentary film is the truth, but it's presented in a way such that you're not going to fall asleep in the movie theater. Okay, it's not just a voice droning at you. So what makes creative nonfiction creative? I always tell my students three things. One, it's creative language, and I don't even necessarily mean poetic or, you know, wildly crazy language, although it may be that. Certainly Tom Wolfe writes with that kind of language. It's just human language.
Is that like ma-ma-ing the flag?
Right, exactly. You know, it's human language. It's language that's not pre-digested or manufactured. It's not cliched. It's not jargony. It's not some vague psychological pop speak. So you're neither using sort of the military industrial complex or the language of advertising that gets jammed down our ears and throats, you know, day to day. But there needs to be a human voice talking to us. And it's not only not using what we think of, you know, people know that it may be cliched to say, you know, this is the best, you know, hamburger you'll ever eat or whatever, but that's the language of advertising, new and improved, you know. But the language we talk about relationships with is cliched, hackneyed language. Hersey wouldn't let us use the word relationship because that, in fact, was not a word. It was a new coinage. Before that, you either had a friendship, a marriage, a love affair. somebody was your boyfriend or your girlfriend or your paramour or your illicit lover, but relationship is just some
vague. But you were not in a relationship.
Yeah, what does that mean? You know, and so if somebody says, you know, I come from a dysfunctional family where there was abuse, but I learned to deal with it. What on earth does that mean? Does that mean that your father used to punch your mother in the face, but you, you know, grew 10 pounds, you know, 10 inches taller and 50 pounds stronger and started lifting weights and learned to, you know, pull your father off your mother and, you know, or does it mean, you had a mother who drank gin all the time and you learned to hide in the room when she was on one of her benders? You know, it just doesn't mean anything. So the first thing is human language, that's your own, the writer's own voice. The second thing is a what makes creative nonfiction is you have your own reason for writing about that material. And usually it's to answer a question about it. And the question comes from the writer. It wasn't handed to you by, you know, somebody else, a boss or, you know. It's why. It answers the so what question. So you can't just tell us a story of the time you almost got killed climbing a mountain or, you know, your horrible divorce or your horrible childhood. Because no matter how good a storyteller you are, we want to know, why are you telling me this? Mm-hmm. Okay. And if you know the answer before you start, it's really just a party story or a weepy anecdote you tell to, you know, your good friend when you're, you know, had too many to drink. But what don't you understand about that story, that part of your life or somebody else's life? Or why are you telling me this? So that central question that you have about the material is important. And then the form, the structure, is what makes the way you present the truth to your readers. Do you tell it as a story, right? So what's not creative are there are a lot of received forms in which people tend to present facts to each other. You know, if you go to law school, you learn the form of a brief. If you become a scientist, you learn how to write up your lab results. If you are a traditional journalist, you used to learn, you know, the inverted pyramid and the who, what, when, what. And it's a form that's given to you, right? You need to write a report or evaluate an employee, and there's a form to do that. It's not very creative, right? But if you're writing creative nonfiction, you find a form that has some kind of organic movement and suspense to it and some natural shape, a story, so that's a narrative. But also you could go on a journey and present, sort of take us along on the journey with you. You could spend some time with another human being and sort of shape what you write about that person along the lines of, well, what is this person doing? Is he building a birch bark canoe? So that John McPhee once did, you know, use that as a shape. Or is the person a mortician and is, you know, taking a body and embalming it and, you know, right through to the burial, and you use that to shape your you know, to answer some question about what it means to be a mortician. You can conduct an experiment. So a lot of participatory journalism that we read now, you can join the professional football team for a year and see if you survive it, or live biblically for a year, or survive on food you grew in your own garden, and use that to shape your presentation of the truth to us. So it's not just a lecture about growing things locally. There's a question: can I survive on food I grew in my own garden? What would that be like? And then there's suspense there, and you take us through that experience with you. So the three things that make creative nonfiction creative: not a creative attitude toward the truth, but creative language, you know, natural human language, a human voice, a question that really comes from a genuine concern that the writer has about the material, and a natural organic form that is creative, and that's...
Now, you wrote the textbook on this,
mm-hmm.
but when I look at the list of your writing,
mm-hmm.
I often see the word novel. So, do you write nonfiction, fiction, creative nonfiction?
I write all of the above. I write short stories, I write novels. I write essay-length creative nonfiction, I write book-length creative nonfiction, and I write some nonfiction that's not so creative, but...
Well, we'd love to hear something that you've written. Could you read something for us?
Sure. Would you like me to start with a novel, with fiction or nonfiction?
Well, you pick.
Well, I was just talking about nonfiction. Why don't I start with that, and then maybe we can move on to the fiction. So this is a piece, this is the opening of an essay called Ranch House. Originally it was called Haunted Ranch House, but the editor had me cut Haunted. It's about the family I grew up in, but the form I use is I took the ranch house, the 50s ranch house in which I grew up, and I structured the piece not as a narrative, so this doesn't follow any one story. What I did was start with one room of the ranch house and move through each room of the ranch house, sort of free associating with that room. And I was trying to answer the question, why did it feel as if my parents were using the house to hide the family history? Was there some deep, dark secret that was being hidden? Why did I always feel as I was growing up as if something was being hidden under all these shiny, new Formica veneer surfaces? Okay, so this is the opening. You'll get the idea. In 1954, my parents drove around Long Island until they found a house they liked. They rode away to get the plans, then built a similar house in the town we lived in. Bad enough to grow up in a cookie-cutter ranch house on Long Island. How much worse to grow up in upstate New York in a cookie-cutter copy of a cookie-cutter ranch house on Long Island. But my parents liked the way the ranch house looked, and the rooms were considered large. Although they wouldn't be anything now, my mother says. The house was completely new. No one had ever died there. No one had been poor or sick. Although my father worried how he could afford the mortgage of $105 a month, my mother assured him his dental practice would only grow, and the house would cost less to maintain and heat than an older, cheaper dwelling. If you were like me and grew up comfortably middle class, you find it hard to credit the poverty and despair that drove your parents to strive to become middle class in the first place. My parents' parents all were immigrants. My mother's father died when she was young. Her mother went to work selling hat and Macy's, and my mother took a job as a secretary for a man who kept trying to pinch her bottom. My father grew up at his parents' shabby hotel in the Catskills, where the family spent the summer hustling to please the guests and the rest of the year huddling to keep warm in the bungalow across the street and living off whatever groceries remained in the pantry at season's end. My father and the other Jewish men who'd survived the war used their GI loans to build ranch houses on two streets carved from a pasture that until then had been owned by a farmer named Champlain. Like most 50s parents, mine viewed their role as providing their children with an orderly, hygienic home, the best medical care money could buy, and a college education. I didn't spend much time with either parent, and when I did, we didn't discuss our inner lives. One of my few opportunities to feel close to my mother came when I sat outside her bathroom and watched her shave. Her body hair seemed erotic, and I coveted her electric razor with its sleek turquoise body and the stainless steel blades you popped up with a button and cleaned with a tiny brush. My most intimate moments with my father revolved around shaving, too. He would lean back and close his eyes while I patted his cheeks with cream, then shaved him with his double-edged chrome Gillette. I was only 5, so the razor didn't contain a blade, but I enjoyed the nearness to my father's flesh, the vitalis he allowed me to smooth through his hair, and the way, when I was done, he would snap his fingers and chant, "Shave and a haircut!" Snap, snap, 2 bits, then hand me a quarter, which I didn't realize at the time was 2 bits. Then I came upon him finishing a real shave, after which he ejected something shiny and thin into a slot at the back of his medicine cabinet. "What was that?" I asked. "What was what? Oh, the blade. You can't shave without a blade, pussycat. That's what cuts off the beard." I might have felt cheated, except that when my father showed me how sharp a blade could be, I grew dizzy and nearly fainted. I asked where the used blades went, and my father said they fell to the basement through a space in the wall, leaving me to think about the walls of our house filling up with razor blades. I think about them still.
How wonderful. And you know, I identified so much with all of those things that you were talking about in there. Help me with why this is creative nonfiction and not memoir.
Well, memoir is a subgenre of creative nonfiction.
Okay,
so if you're writing about stuff that already happened and that happened to you, and you're using all the techniques I was talking about before, it's memoir. But not all creative nonfiction is about the self, and not all of it is about stuff that's already happened. So you might decide you have a question about your grandmother's hometown, the farm there, right? So you set off on a journey, and you do some detective work to figure out, you know, why did your great-grandparents really leave their farm in Oklahoma during the 30s? How bad was the Dust Bowl? And so you might write a piece of creative nonfiction about that. Well, it's not memoir because it's not strictly about you. And it moves, it's not based on something that happened in your past, right? But it's still creative nonfiction. It's just a different category of creative nonfiction.
Now, Eileen, you also write novels, and you have a new one out.
I do.
Breaking and Entering, a novel. Tell me, when you are approaching the keyboard and the subject, do your novels come out of a place that isn't inside you? I mean, how does something become a novel versus creative nonfiction, or is that one long continuum and just further along somewhere?
Well,
I guess I'm asking how much of your novel is in you.
Yeah. Right. Well, as I said, I have a strict line between the fiction and the nonfiction. So when I write nonfiction, to the best of my ability, I'm saying this happened, you know, this is the way I remember it. It might be that my sister remembers it differently, but, you know. And if I don't remember something, I'll say, you know, I imagine or I think this is what happened. Fiction, I will write fiction if I need to protect people, you know, so I want to really cover my tracks or protect myself. If I want to make lots of changes or I'm going to be making up large pieces of something. So it's more if something, it's usually something in real life inspires the fiction, but it's just a seed. And I want to be free to let that seed grow into whatever it wants to grow into. I want to be able to shape it, maybe connect it with other things from other parts of my life, other people, and use those pieces and things that I make up to. And it really is just, you know, I look at the material and I just think, is there something in this that gains its power from its truth value? You know, if people knew that I wasn't making this up, it would be much more powerful than if they thought I was making it up, in which case I do it as nonfiction. And if what I really want to do is use the germ, the ingredients, but bake them into my own cake, you know, then it's going to be fiction. So this novel is inspired by real events. I moved to Michigan in 1994 with my then husband, and I had lived in the Midwest before. I had gone to grad school in Iowa, and certainly life in Ann Arbor was not that much different from life even on the East Coast. But I started to venture out into other parts of Michigan. I was doing some writers in the schools gigs, and I started to see that there were very, very different kinds of people all living in this one state. It was sort of before people were talking about red states and blue states, but Michigan is a purple state, which means not that it's blended, but that there are very, very different kinds of people living within the borders of the same state and often in the borders of the same city or little tiny town.
More of a pointless depiction of purple.
Exactly.
Lots of red and blue.
And it was fascinating to me that people who were so different were supposed to, in a democracy, create some sort of coherent government without people killing each other, as they do in other countries. And I'm Jewish, and there are Jews in Ann Arbor, but much of Michigan, many people are fundamentalist Christians of various persuasions, and I wasn't used to sort of being in a school and finding out that most of the biology teachers were creationists. I just couldn't kind of wrap my mind around that. And you had, again, people had very different notions about religion, science, and the government. So there were people like me, and you know, I'm a good liberal, and I think the federal government is here to make our lives better and give everybody good education and medical care and help poor people. And there were people in Michigan who, and there are people in Michigan who believe that the federal government is their big enemy. The government's going to send black helicopters full of commandos who are going to take away their guns and put them in concentration camps run by blacks and Jews and homosexuals. And I was very interested in this. And then not long after I moved to Michigan, Timothy McVeigh blew up the Murrah office building in Oklahoma City, and it turned out that his co-conspirators, one of the McNichols brothers, was from Michigan, and it was quite likely that McVeigh had trained at least once with the, or gone to a meeting of the Michigan militia. And there was a very vociferous and vitriolic radio talk show host who lived not far from my own house and worked at the university where I taught, who was very much in favor of what McVeigh had done. And so I became very interested, kind of scared, nervous, and interested. So I did a lot of research on the militias. And then I met a woman in Ann Arbor who had moved with her husband from Marin County in Northern California, which is very liberal, moved to a small town in Michigan, and found that they were really, her, she wasn't Jewish, but her husband was, and found that they were really at odds with their neighbors over these kinds of issues. And then their house burned down, and it looked like it was arson. They thought they had been burned out by their neighbors, and the town charged them with burning down their own house to collect the insurance. So I thought, I think I have a novel here. Because I had the intersection of a story, you know, I had characters and a story with some questions that I wanted to explore, which is how really do people who are so different, how can we expect them to live in the same city, state, country? And what are these differences? And what happens when there's a mutual paranoia, such as grew up in this little town between my friend's family and the other townspeople? I also am really interested in passion and when it acts for the good, when it makes your life exciting and gives you a reason to live, you know, passion for religion or for politics or for another person, and when it becomes dangerous. So these were some of the questions I decided to explore in the novel Breaking and Entering, and I used little bits of my friend's story as the seed for the plot, although it quickly became not her.
I want to talk just for a moment about your preparation for sitting down.
Mm-hmm.
In creative nonfiction, yes, just we could tell from your description of the elements of creative nonfiction that you need to do a lot of research. But in describing your preparations for Breaking and Entering, it sounds like you also did a lot of research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at some point, the way you prepare to write must be different if you're, as you said, baking your own cake, or not.
It is, but really the only difference, I think, is that when you bake a nonfiction cake, you're given most of the ingredients by what really happened, okay, or your research, and then you figure out how to bake those, and which ingredients to use, and how to bake them into a cake. For fiction, you are given some of the ingredients through whatever really is inspiring the work, so the real life bits, and your research, but you actually have to kind of grow a lot of your own ingredients yourself. And so you have to do that first. And that's kind of a process of messing around with what I call zero draft. So you're not thinking in terms of, oh, this is a first draft. You're really doing a lot of writing to just figure out who your characters really are and what the story really is. And once you know that and why you're writing the book, so again, you need a central question to answer the so what, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction. But if you're kind of making up the story part, which is given to you by nonfiction, but which you have to more or less concoct yourself. And once you have that, then you have all the same ingredients you would have had for the nonfiction cake, and you go about baking it, which, of course, is still a kind of messy process, but at least you now have your ingredients. And everybody, you know, every writer has a different method, but some people that I know kind of do all this work sentence to sentence as they go along, and they write extremely slowly, but when they're done, they're done. Whereas I just make these huge messes for a couple of years in my kitchen, and then I go, okay, now I have my ingredients, I know what kind of cake I'm baking, I clear everything up, and then I start with the actual, you know, now we're going to bake the cake. And I found that whichever kind of writer you are, it pretty much takes the same length of time overall. Because the person who writes sentence to sentence and won't go on with the second sentence until the first is perfect and they figured out what they need, you know, doesn't have to do a lot of revision at the end. Whereas, you know, I'm just doing these massive revisions, throwing things away and starting over.
I'm dying to hear some of this.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you. Okay. So this is near the beginning. And the main character's name is Louise Shapiro. And again, as she says, her husband's the Shapiro. She was born a Hines. And they've moved to the small town of, well, they've moved to the city of Pottawatomie, Michigan, from Marin County. And her husband has a job at the state prison there. He's a psychiatrist, so he's the head psychiatrist at the prison. She has not been able to find a job. She is a school social worker / psychologist. And she hadn't anticipated this, but she is, in fact, too liberal to be hired by any of the schools. And it's taken her a long time to figure out why she wasn't even getting any interviews. They've moved to this town to start over because her husband has had some reverses. So she doesn't even really want to be there, but she's moved for the sake of the marriage. And now she finally has a job interview at a school. She desperately wants this job, and as it starts. And so, on this dreary day in March, Louise is driven to Pottawatomie, where she turns in the high school lot and parks in a spot marked Visitors, hoping that the next time she comes here, she might park in the lot for staff. Bowing to the wheel, she offers the sort of prayer a person offers before an interview for a job that might save her life. She locks the van, then stands in the misty chill, looking up at the building she hopes to work in. Pottawatomie High School, Southwest Michigan football champions, 1990-91. It reminds her of the school she attended in upstate New York, a Gothic WPA brick-and-mortar fortress, which, unlike her parents' house, seemed remarkably solid, not to mention that it was supervised by adults who, unlike her parents, seemed to have her best interests at heart. She pushes open the metal doors with their grid of wire diamonds embedded in the glass, and immediately she feels at home. She once read that dogs can sniff out the ingredients of a baking cake, and as remarkable as that feat seems, Louise is certain she can identify every separate smell in the corridor of a high school. The wet sheep musk of drying sweaters, the boyish bravado of Brute and Old Spice, the zest of rotting gym socks, the hunger-inducing scent of cinnamon toast from home ec, and the cheerfully industrious tang of sawdust and oil from shop. She trots up the stairs and runs her fingers along the lockers. The gargantuan trophies in the display case are topped with brass-plated players almost large enough to be the real teenage boys who won them. Please, she prays, let me get this job. Let me walk down these halls to my office and spend the morning listening to whatever students need me. Let me unfold my sandwich in the lunchroom and talk to the other grown-ups about whatever happened in the news the night before. Let me pick up my daughter from a decent school and take her home to an orderly, well-lit house. Let my husband come to bed and make love to me the way he used to.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Thanks.
And that is Breaking and Entering.
Yes.
You've done several other books, Paradise, New York, The Rabbi in the Attic, and other stories, and In the Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Those also, according to what I looked at, were novels.
No. Actually, just Paradise, New York is a novel. And the other two, Rabbi in the Attic and In the Mouth, are collections of short stories and novellas.
Oh, okay. But all are
fiction.
Fiction.
They're all fiction.
So tell me, where does one go to read your creative nonfiction?
Well, I have a book of creative nonfiction, which sadly is out of print. It's called Woman Walking Ahead in Search of Catherine Weldon and Sitting Bull. It was published by the University of New Mexico Press, and we're going to be trying to get it back up on as an ebook, which was about a white woman who lived with Sitting Bull during the last few years of his life and was accused of causing the last great Lakota uprising. Nobody really ever knew much about who she was, where she came from, where she went afterward, and I was sort of bitten by the bug. I needed to find out. So it's a story of me following her trail sort of as a history detective, even though I have no training in history, and trying to figure out more about her. And then the rest, I have a lot of essays that have been published in various literary magazines. The one I just read was from New England Review, Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, Michigan Quarterly Review. So I've had, you know, and I'm hoping to be able to collect them at some point. And I have a memoir that I just finished about my time at Yale, and that one my agent is just sending around right now.
So a very, very busy, busy writer. We are almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask one quick question about process, about time in the seat. What is your process?
Time in the seat every morning. I don't get up at the crack of dawn, but I get up, you know, fairly early and put in a couple of hours before I get on to my teaching or being a mother or whatever else I have to do that day. And I find if I put in at least an hour or two or three every day, 7 days a week, it really adds up.
How quickly do you show your manuscripts?
Too quickly. I always think it's done, and then people say, no. And I rewrite and rewrite, and I show my work to lots of people. I can see everyone else's, you know, weaknesses, the way they can improve, and I still have a tough time seeing it on myself, but I am very fortunate in friendship and readership and editorship. So
you have the new novel, again, Breaking and Entering. You have the memoir coming out about going to Yale, which I assume you have finished writing.
Yes.
What are you working on now?
I'm really just kind of potting around because I'm sure I'll have to do revisions on the memoir if someone buys it. And I just finished with my co-authors, Natalie Bacopoulos and Jeremiah Chamberlain, another textbook. It's a nonfiction textbook for freshmen, college freshmen, called Creative Composition. And so we're doing the final edits on that as well.
Well, I feel like I ought to buy all of your textbooks. Thank you so much for joining us
thanks,
today.
Thanks, Patty. It was my pleasure, really.
We've been talking with Eileen Pollack, the author of Breaking and Entering. Thanks for joining us today on The Writer's Voice. I'm Patty Campbell for The Virginia Voice.